kpfk.org. I am Gregorio Luque, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and throughout the world, you can contact us at www.kpfk.org.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week, we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
Bridges Across Homelands is a short film featuring interviews with Jewel Gomez, Kim Shuck, Stephanie Ann Johnson, and Madeline Lim. These trailblazers have changed our communities as artists and activists.
If you place us and our leadership, those of us who are the most vulnerable, then that way everyone else is cared for. See us as a bridge to other women, whether they're of color or not.
We are the hub, and spokes go out from the hub all the way around the world. And I think we are that in so many ways.
A lot of my writing is about how we break through the roles we've been assigned to.
Art and activism aren't separate things. When we got that statue taken up, that horrible, degrading statue, it meant that our voices matter in the way that we get represented in history.
Being a lighting person is a dangerous profession. Something's not wired properly, somebody's not footing your ladder, and I was young and frightened because they didn't want me there. It was clear. So we've made our own work.
Leaving behind a legacy, I'm really hoping that, you know, in the past 25 years, you know, we had anywhere between 20 to 40 participants each year, that, you know, we're moving the needle in terms of the stories that are told about our communities.
One of the things that was really interesting about doing the Gilda stories ultimately was, as I was writing it, I knew that I enjoyed vampire stories and I had read vampire stories. I'd seen the movies, but I didn't understand that there's like this cult following of vampires.
If we're not the ones making films of our lives, our experiences, our communities, who's going to?
That was the trailer for Bridges Across Homelands, which is a new doc film from multidisciplinary storyteller Jen Cheng. And we are very excited to have Jen join us today to talk about the film, to talk about how it was made and, you know, what she brings to community in the way of connecting with all of these elders, these women that we want to learn from. So Jen is a poet, a writer, a musician, an improviser, an artist, all these things. Also the poet laureate of the city of West Hollywood. And welcome to Feminist Magazine, Jen.
Thank you, Lynn, for having me. It's a pleasure to always have a conversation with you.
I'm also really looking forward to it and excited to actually also see the film, which we should say up front is premiering Saturday, October 5th, and that's during the Circa Festival for LGBTQ History Month. And let's talk about what inspired you actually to start this project. This is actually part of a larger project, I know, and it's kind of bringing together many parts of your whole storyteller self and also your community connector self, right?
Yes, I want to welcome everyone to come see the film on Saturday, October 5th at 2 p.m. at Greenway Court Theater. It's on the campus of Fairfax High School off of Fairfax and Melrose, free parking where you would park for the flea market. And to say, yes, it's part of the Circa Queer Histories Festival, and all of us know somebody queer or have a non-binary cousin or nephew, and that allies need to see this, that all women, non-binary, male allies, whoever you are, we all enjoy the arts. And sometimes we don't get the behind the scenes life and how people create their art,
right,
when it's not a big, you know, celebrity from Hollywood. So that's what I want to encourage everyone to say, hey, these people have made a great creative career, and I myself am working on my creative career. So there's something for everyone. How did they sustain themselves? How did they find community? How did they decide or accidentally become leaders? And sometimes it's inseparable. For me, I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I was so fortunate to fall into student journalism. I am naturally curious, and one of my mentors, special thanks to Marcy Gallo for introducing me to Jewel Gomez, and that is what started this short film. In general, I care about legacy. I care about intergenerational communication and storytelling and sharing. And I am a Gen Xer. I'll just come right out and tell you my age. I'm a Gen Xer who is fortunate to know these trailblazers who did it at a time in the 70s and 80s when women were not welcome in a lot of workplaces. And forget being a person of color, forget being queer, forget being quirky. So just to be an unusual creative person in an uncharted territory where it's not a clear path, and these people have made it.
They've all made it on their own terms, in their own ways, but it feels to me, just from knowing a little of who they all are and also how they've interwoven their creative careers with being true to themselves, with their activism, with community, it feels like they're all worth learning from, right?
Yeah. And Jewel is retiring with working on a sequel for the Gilda Stories. And the Gilda Stories celebrated their 25th anniversary several years ago. So it's a long-awaited sequel that we want to hear from Jewel, where these characters go. And this is a life work. It's not easy to get published. And the first edition came through an independent press. And when you're not welcome in the mainstream, you find the independent publishers, the independent theaters, the indie artists who will support you. And that is how trailblazers and community leaders find their way. They didn't do that on their own. We all need each other to support each other. So this is an example of how sometimes things take time and sometimes you're ahead of your time. And creating a life and giving a journey for your projects sometimes takes a whole village, a whole national network of people who support you.
Exactly. And when you ask them questions, because you have the four women who are part of this film, when you ask them questions about what advice they would give to someone starting out in their 20s, was there sort of a common thread from the four of them, a common piece of advice?
Well, for some people, you're lucky to just be in the right space, right? And that when you grow up in a place like San Francisco, where it's a tighter, smaller community, it's easier to find who can help you, who you can learn from. A universal thread that anyone can take is taking classes, finding the teachers and mentors who really inspire you, and they draw fellow classmates that you can be friends with, that can help you out, that can lead you to other activities. So whether being in the right place in the right time is a lucky streak you have, or forging your own way by finding the right places that you can meet your peers who can help you along.
Yeah, absolutely. Talking about also the multiple identities, you yourself bring multiple identities, and you talk about immigrant, Asian American, woman, queer, all these different identities. And so you also particularly chose these amazing exemplars of creativity who have multiple identities, and you talk to them about how they navigated their work with all these identities. who did you learn from? Give us a couple of examples of their advice around how they navigate.
Kim Shuck is a fellow poet laureate, poet laureate emerita of San Francisco, and is a queer biracial, bisexual, and in different places she's seen for different parts of herself. And so when she goes back to where she grew up with her grandma in the Cherokee community that she belongs to, she's more seen as an indigenous person. And knowing that she presents light skin and white elsewhere, some of her identities get erased and not seen. And that is something I feel a lot, even though we don't share the same ethnic background. As an Asian American and somebody who doesn't speak with an accent, you know, sometimes we think about our demographics, but there are other identities that we have, that we're college educated or working class or not speaking with an accent or have multiple languages. Some of those identities get erased. And that's part of my mission, is to celebrate intersectionality, that when I teach a poetry workshop, this weekend I taught a poetry workshop, people felt seen because one of my identities or several of them would overlap with theirs. And I hope that that's what people get out of seeing this film, this short documentary film, that they see a little something of themselves from each of these interviewees. Jewel Gomez is famous for her work as a writer, and she's also a philanthropist, has been on arts commissions, and as a philanthropist, she has made decisions that have helped raise up communities, raise up artists who might not have gotten funding, who might not have had the skills to drive their creative careers. So not only is she an artist herself, she has uplifted other artists. And I think that is my hope as a cultural leader myself, is to uplift others. And that's why we have a panel discussion following the film with poets Sonia Guinyan-Saka and artist Andy Choch. I am friends with them because, thanks to you, Lynn, you introduced me to Sonia, and we had a wonderful literary salon featuring them. Sonia spoke and I felt like there was a rapport. Sonia represents undocumented migrant rights, whether you're an artist, a family, you're a blue-collar worker. So I think Sonia has a lot to bring to our conversation. My friend Andy, who runs Latinx with Plants, is a BIPOC entrepreneur in a neighborhood that is a developing neighborhood, and she leads a lot of community activities at a plant shop. You don't normally think a plant shop is where you go to get art classes or poetry salons, but Andy has that vision of being a hub. And that's where intersectionality is that we become hubs and people from parts of our identities can come join us and feel connection to a larger community.
Yes, I love that idea of a hub and the way that connections can be made in different directions. And it's also very horizontal, I think, rather than hierarchical. And it feels that you chose these four particular subjects for this documentary, as well as the two for your panel, because they're all doing that, right, in different ways. So tell us also about why you chose these particular four San Francisco sort of luminaries to be in the documentary.
Well, in general, I feel like it's very important to have wisdom from our elders. I grew up Chinese American, and that is very instilled in my version of Chinese culture,
right,
to really remember our elders. And also, as a queer person, I really look for chosen family. And chosen family is sometimes not obvious and maybe not geographically close to you. So I took this opportunity to interview folks who may not travel or be present in Los Angeles, knowing that I had this event that I was putting together as part of a City of West Hollywood artist grant. I promised to bring together a conversation about intersectionality. And I thought, hey, this is an excuse to find a way to create a more national dialogue, something that is outside our local Angeleno perspective, so that we have cross-pollination. That's my hope as a multidisciplinary artist, that I hope to cross-pollinate across different disciplines. And hopefully in this conversation, we bring in wisdom from different generation and different geographies. Sonia is also a transplant from Ecuador and recently moved here from New York. So I think there's so many ways that we are transplants and from different communities.
Oh, no, exactly. So you've got, we've talked a little bit about Jewel Gomez, who we all know, and you also have Madeline Lim included, and she's a filmmaker and founder of the Queer Woman of Color Media Arts Project. And it's sort of her own individual work and then how she created something that's larger, that has affected and influenced and enabled the creative growth of so many people, right? So how much of that is also part of, I don't know, your artistic mission, I guess?
Yes. All the four interviewees are educators like I am. And when you're a teacher, you're giving people tools to take their career further. And Madeline wanted to see more queer women of color filmmakers. When she first started, she was the only one at either the queer film festivals or either at the Asian American film festivals in all the different identities. She didn't see many people looking like her. And for us to create film, which is an expensive project, we need crews, we need teams, and we need to connect with others, and we need to have the technical skills. I couldn't have done this project without tapping two straight Asian male allies who actually learned a lot from these interviews. So I have a straight woman editor, white woman editor, working on this BIPOC documentary. So we all need each other and we need to have the technical skills. And when you teach one, they bring those skills to another team and we can populate and grow a larger community of storytellers.
Exactly. And I think that's very much the lesson here. And also looking at this concept of elders, I feel that we went through a phase where there was a lot of dismissal of elders. And now I'm feeling that we're coming back into a generation of younger, you know, artists and activists who really want to know their elders' stories and want to learn. And it's also a two-way conversation, right? Elders are also learning. So how much is that an influence in how you chose to put this together?
I love that Stephanie Ann Johnson is a lighting designer who felt unwanted in her career. She is one of the first two Black women lighting designers in the entire country. And she says that on crews in at least the theater world where she works, she's getting young, straight white men who say, how can I help you? Stephanie talks about how she doesn't have the technical skills and hires a younger assistant to handle the tech aspects of producing whatever maps she needs. She still draws her sketches by hand on pen and paper on her drafting table, and then you'll see that in the film. And then she hands that off to a younger assistant who puts it through whichever design program that they need to use to communicate with the rest of the team. So I think there's a beauty in having this intergenerational teamwork that young folks are willing to offer someone who doesn't look like them a chance to say, hey, how can I help you? How can I do my job better?
And I think one of the sort of back and forth givings across generations is also the other back and forth giving you're talking about is bridging across countries, across identities, right? So would you say bridging is like a big and deep part of how you create your projects?
I'll connect this to the original, This Bridge Called My Back. This Bridge Called My Back was a foundational anthology edited by Shari Moraga and Gloria Anzaldúa that I think is mandatory reading for anybody interested in intersectionality, anyone interested in feminism, anyone interested in just learning more about how we are not automatically a melting pot. The United States is not an automatic melting pot. We have to actively, consciously choose to connect with each other. I say that as a child of immigrants, I connect well with other immigrants and transplants because we have a curiosity. We have to forge a new way of creating a new community. We're not like the others who were born and raised in Los Angeles and comfortable with their high school friends. And those of you who are comfortable with your high school friends, that's a privilege. Hurrah to you, and please come to this film screening, because give yourself a chance to meet others who want to have your back, and we want you to have our back. We want to connect with everyone and get a little bit uncomfortable, be a little bit more curious, and connect with people who might not be your obvious friend from your high school. Maybe, you know, it's somebody new you met at the farmer's market. Maybe it's somebody new you meet as an art vendor.
Right. All those ways of expanding our, not our consciousness, but our view and ways of connecting to others. I love that. And I completely agree with you on that one. So tell us, Jen, what else are you working on right now? And how much longer are you Poet Laureate of West Hollywood? What else is going on for you creatively?
Thank you for having this conversation on the Feminist Magazine. I am finishing my first year out of my 3-year term this October, and I want to welcome people to come to any of my poetry events. You'll find me on Instagram at Jen C. Voice or anywhere on social media at J-E-N C. Voice, V-O-I-C-E, or my website has a monthly calendar posted on the webpage. And please come check out more about the documentary project. If you can't come to the film screening, I still invite you to connect with me. And if we connect and you feel like sending in a donation, I'll send my donors a private link for you to watch in the comfort of your home. It's okay that you can't come out to October 5th. It is an opportunity for us to build community. But there are other things that I do that are online, like teaching poetry workshops. And as a poet laureate, I am going to have office hours at our local business in West Hollywood, Fangirl Cafe. They are a queer BIPOC. Yeah, they are a queer BIPOC business, and I want to support them. So as I'm going to celebrate my 1-year anniversary, I'm going to, you know, invite you come be an introvert. If you're not into big theaters or big events, you can come have a one-on-one Q&A with me on Saturday, October 26th. I invite people to engage with poetry and the arts in whichever way suits your personality. And I, as an introvert, understand sometimes you don't want to go to a crowd. So that's why I'm holding office hours.
I love that idea. That's like a super communal way to connect with people. And also, I think, demystify, like, what is a poet laureate? What do you do? And you're the storyteller for the city, but you're creating all these programs, which is wonderful.
Yeah. And for those of you who don't know what a poet laureate does, which is quite a common question, I'm serving as a cultural ambassador, encouraging literacy, teaching classes, opening opportunities for people to be involved with poetry. And I welcome people to West Hollywood with a poem. And that is one part of being a multidisciplinary artist. And this other part, which we're talking about, Bridges Across Homelands, is a documentary film. And it happens to be part of the Circa Festival that you, Lynn, you were part of the selection committee. Tell us how you were part of Circa. We should talk a little bit about Circa being a month-long celebration, shedding light on our history together.
Oh, right. I think you've said it all. It's this month-long celebration of community-curated, community-created events. And it's all over the city. There are art events, film events, creative writing events, panel discussions. So your links will all be on the Feminist Magazine website, and I'll pop the Circa link and calendar onto the Feminist Magazine website as well, so folks can find out more about that. So let's just circle back to remind folks that this premiere of your short documentary is happening October 5th, 2 to 4 p.m., and it's at the Greenway Court Theater on Fairfax Avenue. And you've got a panel discussion after the film, but you're also going to have art vendors, and you're going to invite people to make art on the spot. So that's also part of the invitation. What is that going to look like?
Well, Greenway Court Theater has a beautiful outdoor lobby area, and so we're free to set up some tables. And so one of our panelists, Andy, with Latinx with Plants, will have merch and things from their store. And Sapphic LA is one of my community partners. And there will be ways that you can make art by thinking of your creative dreams and putting it on a post-it and seeing who else wants to make the same kind of art. And maybe y'all can mingle and get to know each other. I like that idea of having spontaneous connections at an event, and hopefully you'll make a new friend while you're making art, while you're mingling. And the film is a sneak peek. It's in its first cut for the community. We shot the interviews in August, and it's been a rapid calendar of getting it together for October 5th. And we encourage you to come hear these interviews and have a discussion. It is not going to be finished. And there's definitely so much more to learn from these elders. If you want to support the project, please read more about it. And we are taking donations at the event and on my website at gencvoice.com/bridges.
Brilliant. We've been talking to Jen Cheng, who's a multidisciplinary storyteller. And this is one of the ways she's doing storytelling right now with this documentary in progress called Bridges Across Homelands. And we'll have all those links on our website as well. Thank you so much, Jen, for joining us today.
Thank you, Lynn. You do such a fabulous job of having these conversations. And Feminist Magazine is the perfect place for us to talk about it.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much, Jen. See you on October 5th.
See you then.
I'll smile, I know what it takes to fool this town. I'll do it till the sun goes down and all through the night time. Oh yeah, oh yeah, I'll tell you.
KPFK General Manager Michael Novick will be doing his monthly report to the listeners, dialoguing with you on Monday, September 30th at 1 p.m., reporting on the state of the station, recent programming changes and volunteer opportunities, and taking your calls, comments, and queries on the studio line. You're invited to tune in and call in with your suggestions and concerns. That's Monday, September 30th at 1 p.m. for the management report to the listeners. Monday is also the deadline for voting for listener delegates to the station governance. So, if you haven't already, it's time to fill out your ballot. Thanks for tuning in to your community radio station, KPFK.
You You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next,
we'll present the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry, a reflection on the rise of women's liberation movement in the United States between 1966 and 1971. She's Beautiful explores the emergence of a political thought that challenged systems of patriarchy. This documentary provides important historical insight at a time when our country is experiencing regression around issues of reproductive rights, equity in the workplace, and violence against women.
Football. The argument has been over for a very long time. Yes. To have the right to choose. We should be mad. Are you mad?
You're not allowed to retire from women's issues. You still have to pay attention because somebody's trying to yank the rug out from under you. And that's what's happening now.
The feminists who are here tonight, do you not believe a woman's place is in the home, right?
As feminists, what we believe in is very simple, and that is the social, economic, and political equality of the sexes. Because the relationship between the sexes is, in fact, a political relationship. We're an oppressed group, and we have been through history.
If you do something as remarkable as changing the relationship between the sexes, everything is at risk, every possible idea. And many people don't like it, especially men don't like it. They're very threatened by it.
Women's Lib really is a lot of insignificant people that are really trying to gain their own interests and boost their own ego by making brash statements or being on television or what have you.
You're so oversensitive, Aldi. Why are you so sensitive?
We don't like being so sensitive. It's not pleasant. We don't like having to always be catching things. We'd rather they didn't exist. But as long as people are going to be insensitive to our position, we're going to have to keep correcting them because there's no other way to change the consciousness.
Women, given their educational status, can earn 60% of what men of the same education can. What that really means is that a woman with college education, BA, earns what a man does who has 3 years of high school. This is economic discrimination and exploitation.
Women as well as men told me I was wrong over and over again. Women are not oppressed. Or what does it matter? Who cares? You have a lot of influence. You were working against cultural norms. You're working against institutions.
How do you feel about women's liberation?
Woman's place is more at home than to advance herself too much.
Totally against it. I feel I don't know what they're being liberated from.
Many women protested that they like cooking and housework and catering to men. But I would argue with some woman who was being extremely defensive about the movement and then 6 months later would run into her at a demonstration.
Prior to the women's liberation movement, most women were conditioned to meet the needs and expectations of men. But the introduction of this new feminist thought allowed women to view themselves as full human beings, equally capable of defining themselves and deciding their own paths. As the civil rights movement dominated the world center stage, women weren't content with being excluded from the conversations of resistance and liberation. Their issues needed to be prioritized as well. Activist Frances Beale.
The Black Liberation Movement had come into its fore, and you're talking about liberation and freedom half the night on the racial side, and then all of a sudden men are going to turn around and start talking about putting you in your place.
If you don't want any trouble.
That was the contradiction in terms that we were no longer prepared to put up with. So 1968, we founded the SNCC Black Women's Liberation Committee to take up some of these issues.
a number of women felt that we need to go off on our own and focus on what we needed to do in our fight for liberation.
I was a graduate student at Berkeley. One day I saw a little 3x5 card in the student union, and it said a women's group forming. And these consciousness-raising groups spontaneously grew up in many areas of the country.
When I first heard about the women's liberation movement, I had two little kids under five. My connection with the world was, I felt, finished. During one of my crises of feeling that my life was over, I heard some young women talking about meetings they were having, and they were talking about women's liberation, and they gave the address of a meeting. So I went to this meeting, and there were these women talking about their lives as I had never imagined people could.
Well, you need to be specially trained to be a housewife. You get married, there's a whole new set of rules. We still have to look a certain way and be a certain way.
We went around the room, and people asked a very simple question. How would your life have been different if you had been a boy?
Why do you think being a woman might limit you as a human being, your possibilities, you know?
Welfare people and whatnot.
We challenged concepts of masculinity. We challenged concepts of femininity. We talked about skin color, how young black women would put cream on in order to make themselves light-skinned.
Suddenly, everything was up for questioning. Women did all of the family and housework and cooking, and the men got to make the living and get all of the attention in the world. Why was that?
Like, we don't even realize what goes on until we sit and compare it with other women.
And we heard each other. We heard each other into speech. You could sense it. You could feel it. You could cut it with a knife, as they say. The room was electric with whatever was going to be shared.
So I said, I've had three abortions, and the last one was within the last year. And I started to cry because I suddenly understood that I wasn't alone, that what I had considered personal embarrassment was something that was part of this whole larger experience.
The big insight of the women's movement was the personal is political. Problems that you felt were happening to you alone probably were your fault. But if it's happening to other people, then it's a social problem and not just a personal problem.
The framing of women's oppression as a societal construct put all the daily personal challenges that women faced into a new broad context. For the first time, women were openly broaching subjects that generations before were too fearful to speak of. Women were demanding the right to control their own bodies and lives without permission from men or the state.
Thousands of women in the United States are hospitalized each year because of post-abortion complications. 5,000 of these women die.
I had a very good friend in high school who went away to college, and she subsequently had an illegal abortion and died. So within 3 or 4 months of going off to college, she was dead.
People tried to self-abort. My best friend took pills, and she had the miscarriage in the dorm shower with the turned on really hard, hoping the noise would muffle her cries of pain.
Some were able to find an abortion. Some had to have the child that they didn't want. All those kinds of experiences we discovered were universal. And abortion became our big unifying issue.
Women have a fundamental right to control their own bodies and to control their own lives.
Our bodies, our lives, our right to decide.
Not since the suffragettes fought for the right to vote has an issue been more critical to women than abortion.
Somewhere around 1970, I went to an abortion rights rally in San Francisco. And it was a sea of white women, very few women of color. And someone grabbed a bullhorn and asked for the African-American women who were there to gather under a tree. And we decided that we would form a group called Black Sisters United. I was very glad that, you know, somebody called African-American women together and said, you know, maybe we have something to talk about that might be a tiny bit different from what's coming from the stage. And indeed we did.
I was invited up to Harlem to speak at a event around abortion. Remember, in the Black Liberation Movement, the big debate is abortion is genocide, women should have babies for the revolution. And I remember going up those stairs and my knees were literally knocking because this was a bunch of nationalists and I was really scared. I concentrated a lot about the deaths of Black women as a result of illegal abortion and how we should be able to choose when we want to have children. So I managed to survive, you know, some of the attacks. And on my way out, twice it happened. One woman said to me, whispered to me, "Thank God you speak up. Thank God you're speaking up." And another, as I was approaching the door, said, "Right on. Right on."
Dear brothers, poor Black women decide for themselves whether to have a baby or not have a baby. Black women are being asked by militant Black brothers not to practice birth control because it's a form of whiteys committing genocide on Black people. Well, true enough. But Black women in the United States have to fight back out of our own experience of oppression, and having too many babies stops us from teaching them the truth, from supporting our children, and from stopping the brainwashing, as you say, and fighting Black men who still want to use and exploit us.
It was very difficult for middle-class white women to have any conception about what was going on in communities of color. And those differences could have been in conversation with each other, but if there isn't even an acknowledgement that there's differences in experience and perspective, and the voice of one is used as the voice of all, then you have a problem.
That was during a period when Black women did not particularly identify with the women's movement.
Mrs. Norton, why are you a Black woman involved in women's liberation?
I'm involved in the struggle for women's rights because I believe women are disadvantaged. Black women are no less than white women. Indeed, Black women far more than white women. Women who have spent their lives working in other women's kitchens have a different kind of handicap than women who have been oppressed for their sex in other ways.
We were grappling with that idea of how do you integrate race, class, and gender. That's the reason why we had some reservations about the term feminism, because feminism was just seemed to be dealing with the female aspect of your being.
It's important to keep in mind that Black women are organized in their own organizations, in their own version of Black women's liberation.
In 1964, a friend mentioned that his sister was pregnant and nearly suicidal. Could I do anything about it? And I was referred through a series of connections to a doctor. Asked him if he would perform an abortion. He said yes. And a few weeks later, someone else called and said they also were looking for an abortion. The word had spread. And at that point, I decided to set up a bit of a system. I was living in a dormitory at the time. And so I told people to ask for Jane. I could tell within the first minute what they were calling about, because there was a pause, there was a hesitance, there was a tension. Many were frightened, because three people discussing an abortion in those days was a conspiracy to commit felony murder.
Jane was this service that was established in Chicago that provided abortions when abortion was illegal. We would have women call us who were in need of the abortion service. And of course, having Jane available without having to refer them to the mob was a godsend.
The group would take in the calls and we would do counseling. Then women would be brought to specific houses on a rotating basis where the procedures would be done.
the service moved every day from somebody's home to somebody's home, which is quite amazing.
I joined the abortion service because I knew that women are sometimes desperate and they are going to hurt themselves in order to end their pregnancies. When I began Jane work, a few dozen women a week were coming through. After about 6 months, there were at least 100 women coming through. Ultimately, one really good abortionist taught Janes how to do abortions with skill and care, and then those Janes taught other Janes. All of us were always aware that what we were doing was illegal, that we could go to jail. You might have to throw everything in your bag and run down the back stairs at any moment. But we understood that it was important work, useful work, necessary work.
What is the relationship of the movement to the whole question of motherhood and the affection of mothers for children and so forth?
It's about being able to have children if you want them and being able not to have children if you don't want them. And if you want to have your kids in daycare centers, if you want to work, then you can do that too.
In the women's movement, the myth was that we hated men, we hated marriage, we hated children. That's not right. The group I was in, we talked mostly about childcare being the absolute precondition for women's emancipation.
One of the earliest battles was for child care. It's a now statement of purpose. We knew that women could not hold jobs and be promoted until society recognized its obligation to help take care of our children.
And I remember at some of the early demonstrations, those who had kids, we would bring the kids. And people would say things like, oh, we can't talk with you nursing the babies and stuff like that. And we would say, show us the daycare center. We'll be happy to bring the kids to the daycare center.
Feminists are accused of wanting women out of the home and leaving children come what may.
We pick women and we talk about 24-hour child care. We mean to have it.
After a great deal of work where feminists were in the leadership, we got close to having a real child care system.
In 1971, amazingly enough, the women's movement, the Congress, the Senate, passed a comprehensive child care act. Most historians don't even remember that. Forget about the rest of society. And President Nixon vetoed it. He said, we don't want to make our women like Soviet women. We want women to take care of their own children.
That was a tragic moment in history. And we've been paying for it ever since. It's one thing for women to pay the price. It's another thing for generations of children to pay the price as well. I can think of, frankly, of no more important issues that early feminists raised than educational child care.
Poor people, black women, women on welfare, are often sterilized against their will. I mean, that's been known to happen.
The same hospital that wants to sterilize the black women will not let a middle-class white woman be sterilized. If she says, I don't want to have any more children, they say, you have to
be crazy.
Be crazy.
You've got a temple.
You have to have a medical reason. You have to be sick. There has to be something wrong with you.
Those things are two ends of the same dimension. It's still the issue of control over one's body, whether it's the right to have children if you want them, or the right not to.
In Puerto Rico, over one-third of the women on the island have been sterilized. That means over one-third of the women are never going to be able to hold a baby in their arms.
Women in Puerto Rico were used as guinea pigs, as a way of controlling the population. And then with that sterilization program being brought to New York City, we actively organized raising the consciousness about this.
Izquierda, no tuyo, izquierda,
The Young Lords Party was dedicated to issues affecting Puerto Ricans in the United States. We were the first ones to begin to articulate an idea of reproductive justice. It's just as important for women in our communities to be able to have children, raise children that don't go hungry, have daycare, as well as have access to birth control and the right to a safe abortion. The kind of developing feminism that we had in the Young Lords was make very clear decision not to separate, to wage struggle internally with our brothers. The men had written this program. One of the points dealt with revolutionary machismo. What an oxymoron. We weren't having it. So we formed a women's caucus and made demands on the men in the organization. It was ultimately changed to, we want equality for women, down with machismo and male chauvinism. It was important that it's not just women making that statement. It should be men saying, yo, brother, that's really a macho attitude you're taking. You need to check your And that's what happened.
You're listening to the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry, a reflection on the rise of the women's liberation movement in the United States between 1966 and 1971. Produced by Pamela Bull, Elizabeth Driehaus, and filmmaker Mary Doerr. This is Making Contact. Subscribe to our podcast or sign up for updates by logging on to our website at radioproject.org. You can also join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Now back to the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry.
One evening in my Tuesday night consciousness raising group, West Village One of New York Radical Feminists, Diane Crothers walked in with a newspaper, It Ain't Me Babe, from San Francisco, and said, there's an article here we all have to read. And it was a story about a woman in Marin County who'd been raped during a hitchhike. We read the article and we went around the room, and it turned out one woman, Sarah, had been raped. And the police said to her, who'd want to rape you?
A friend of mine was raped at knife point in her bed in off-campus housing. I went with her to the Student Health Service, and she was given a lecture on her promiscuity.
It was very common in a courtroom to blame the woman for the rape. And rape was looked at as a crime that occurred because a man had strong sexual urges that he couldn't satisfy any other way. And it was only with the feminist woman that it came out that rape is not a crime of passion. It's a crime that expresses the urge to dominate.
People were not used to thinking of rape as a political crime against women. That was our slogan, rape is a political crime against women.
I think the most profound thing that feminism did for me was to make me feel that I was capable of genuine freedom. Before the women's movement, I had my own work. I knew I wasn't going to live a traditional woman's life. I felt that I probably wasn't going to have children. And ultimately, I did have my daughter. And I think, were it not for feminism, I don't think I could have done that.
Right after I got out of college, it was November 2006, my mother passed away, and I got all of these letters and emails from her friends, her colleagues, all of the feminists that started the Women's Liberation Movement, and I started to realize that even though I was down with the word feminism, I didn't really know what it meant to me and to our generation. I think the sexism that we experience is a little bit more insidious, and it's harder to sort of point out and say, see, that's sexism. But I know a lot of young kick-ass feminists out there, they're blogging, they're out in the streets, they're organizing.
What are you doing, you're under attack?
Stand up, fight back!
What are you doing, you're under attack?
Stand up, fight back!
The problem is rapists, and we need to address the problem. And let me give you a hint, it's not our clothes. It's not.
There's this new movement called Slut Walk that has now swept 70 different cities. And it was started by a young woman who heard a cop say about a woman who was raped, well, she was asking for it, she was dressed like a slut.
Believe it or not, people are assaulted regardless of what they wear. Some people who get raped are in burqas.
NYPD rape is a felony!
We created a revolution that we are still debating in our society. We're still arguing over many issues that women raised 40 years ago, like abortion, like childcare. We still don't have any child care.
In terms of reproductive health, reproductive justice, we've gone backward in a big way.
The bitter lesson is that no victories are permanent. All our rights are like that. They're only as good as we maintain them.
Again, that's the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry. Special thanks to the film's producers, Pamela Bowl, Elizabeth Driehaus, and director Mary Doerr.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. And thanks to all of the contributors today, especially to Making Contact Radio. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. Don't forget, you can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter and sharing behind-the-scenes photos on Instagram. Or just email us, oldschoolstyle, @feministmagazine@yahoo.com. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, too. Today's intro music was by Maya Jane Coles. Thanks for listening.
Hey, Scott Horton here to let you know that Anti-War Radio is at Thursday afternoons at 2:30 here on KPFK. For a dozen years, I've brought you the best experts, journalists, and activists working to end the American empire. Check out the archives, more than 5,800 interviews going back to 2003 at scotthorton.org. Talk to you Thursday at 2:30.
The KPFK election balloting period has begun. All eligible voting members will receive an e-ballot via email or a link via text message or a letter in the mail. If you have not received a ballot, please file a ballot request on elections.pacifica.org. If you do not have access to a computer and require telephone assistance, please leave a message for the election supervisor on 707-500-1910. You have until September 30th to cast your vote.
Support comes from the Will Gear Theatricum Botanicum, returning June 1st through October 20th with outdoor repertory theater and educational programs for all ages. The Theatricum's signature production of Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream is back alongside The Winter's Tale, Wendy's Peter Pan, a fresh take on the J.M. Barrie classic of A Boy Who Wouldn't Grow Up, Tartuffe Born Again, a new translation and adaptation of the Molière masterpiece, and the Hispanic, Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latine Vote. The Will Gear Theatricum Botanicum is located in the heart of Topanga Canyon, just off the 101 freeway in the shade of the California Live Oaks. For further information and tickets, visit www.theatricum.com or go to kpfk.org.
Thank you.
The benefits of donating your used vehicle to KPFK include funding new and existing programming, as well as increasing community awareness. You also benefit by being able to reduce your taxable income. There's no need to deal with the hassles of selling it, and you support public radio in the process.